Battlefields, Reel 5, Sergeant Woodcraft continued.
The lucky one after the stand down sank to the bottom of the ditch. We were very, very tired by now. Our eyes felt full of grit. They burnt, and it was very difficult to stay awake. And then you stood and you gazed into that damn wood, and every now and then there'd be a rustle through the undergrowth. A branch would fall off the tree that had probably been loosened by shell fire during the day. And all the time you're fighting this insane desire to fall asleep. And you'd gaze at your watch and you'd find 10 minutes had gone. You'd think an hour had passed. Then finally, 2 hours were up, you reach down, pick up your companion, shake him, get him on his feet, because if you didn't, he'd be back on the floor again, and then you would sink to the ground yourself, and you'd be off out like a light. We did have our moments of interest, and rather laughable things did happen. We had a Lance Corporal Phelps. He was a great tower of strength. He fed us, kept us supplied with ammunition. He made the crossing across the road several times a day, and we had a very persistent sniper. And he used to dash across that road, ammunition, perhaps a billy can full of tea. 7 or 8 times he'd make it safely. The 9th time he'd be get one go very near to him, and he'd come into the ditch in a racing dive. The contents of the Dixie would be spilt. He'd be pulled up, dusted down, "Are you all right?" And then with a word of encouragement, say, "You are an awkward bastard, go back and get some more." The other thing was, this sniper who used to trouble us, we did try and have a go to find him. He was firing, again, you must visualise that those trees aren't there. Somewhere in the trees at the back of the chateau, he was evidently strapped to a tree. And he was, when you see the strike of the shot, you'll see he was virtually firing down the line of that ditch. So one day I tied my mess tin to a stick and placed on that tree. Took it down, nothing happened. Placed it up again, took it down. This time I was rewarded with a strike of a shot actually in the tree. From then on we butt marked for him. We gave him inners, outers, magpies. And every time we went and indicated where the shot had struck, we kept him fully in the picture. We also gave him the flag on one occasion for a complete miss by waving our aircraft recognition panel. I don't know if we got him. Our Bren was firing from a position there, spraying the trees. We never know if we were successful or not. On the 12th of June, things began to really hum in this area. All the sounds now were the small arms fire, the crack of mortars, high explosive, the maddened cattle running around this field. The chateau was alight, or the outbuildings were alight. There's a pall of smoke all over this field, and everywhere was this appalling stench. It was in our clothing. We just couldn't get rid of it. From the animals laying about here, the German dead, we'd had weather very similar to we've had for the last 3 days. Then around about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, a company of the Black Watch came up, moved into that ditch, and with great relief we moved just across the road. It seemed like heaven to get back across there. And that night we had a wonderful sound picture of the Battle of Breville. We got an awful lot of overs coming through. Better keep our heads down. And early next morning there was a welcome sight of the Oxen Bucks coming up to relieve us. And then about 90 to 100 survivors of 9th Battalion, very tired, picked up their few belongings and slowly made their way back in a line at the rear of the brickworks at Blamino Crossroads. Thank you, gentlemen.
The next recording is Nigel Taylor, who on D-Day commanded A Company 7 Para, and it tells the story of his battle in the village of Benouville after landing on the DZ and crossing over Pegasus Bridge with his company, and then spending the next day fighting in Benouville.
as we came over the bridge. Just to orient you again, the sea and Wistrom, that way north about 7 miles. Behind me, Caen and the south, again about 7 miles. And you don't need a pocket calculator to work out we're just about halfway between Caen and the sea. This village was very much as you see it today. Here, there was a high wall went round this, what is now a builder's yard here, and my recollection is there was another house on this side. That house over there, the white one, is obviously new, but there was a house there then. It blew up and burnt out during the day. This house here is also new, but there was again a house there at that time, and that also burnt out during the course of the day. The line of houses that you can see to your front mark a road which runs down to a crossroads about 150 yards up here. And there's another road runs down into the village, the other half of the village on the other side of the road. That farm was there, all that was there, and this house. Now, we came up through this village on the route which you come in the buses, and I decided that I ought to try and get some information about what enemy there might be in this village. And I went into a house, one of the small cottage, and you know what it is if you ask your way in the country, you always manage to get the village idiot. Well, I didn't get the village idiot, but I think I got the two oldest inhabitants of the village. They were very frightened. They took a lot of convincing that we were not some sort of Germans going doing an exercise or something, but they eventually got it. And the difficulty then, they were so pleased to see us, was to get out again. They didn't want to let us go. But we did get out in the end, but we had no information from them whatsoever. And we came on up along this road. Now, I was putting one platoon, my Cameronians, up in that farm to your right, one platoon on this side of the crossroads, and the other third platoon down in that half of the village. And we were moving up here with the sections of the leading platoon staggered on either side of the road. And it was all dead quiet. It had been quiet all the way along. There had been no, I'd heard and seen no firing whatsoever on the DZ. And as we came up through here, a German motorbike started up just beyond those houses, that line of houses I referred to just now. And he came down to the crossroads and turned left, straight down this road. And I suppose every man in that leading platoon took a shot at him. And they hit him. And he swerved across the road. I was moving up on the right-hand side of the road, just behind the leading platoon. He swerved across and crashed into the wall there, just at my feet. And as he died, he must have turned the throttle wide open. Because this big twin-cylinder BMW, he was a DR, was on top of him with the engine absolutely roaring away. It was still in gear, so the back wheel was spinning, and every time the wheel touched the ground, it would bounce the whole bike about. And we had a hell of a job to get hold of the bike and shut the engine off. We got it shut off, got it off him. He was dead, but underneath was my leading platoon commander. And he died about 20 minutes later. Now, that wasn't good. It shouldn't have happened. I think the only reason was this, well, it was the reason, that for a long time those men had been trained to kill Germans. They'd been told, that's your job, to kill Germans, and here was the first one they had ever seen. But it was a sad business. Well, we sorted ourselves out from that and got the platoons into position. I have my company headquarters just down here. Those pylons weren't there then, but there were telegraph poles along here. And the Germans had dug, just on the edge of the road, a very conveniently situated slit trench, which I took over. They were, did in fact have slit trenches all up and down these roads, all over Normandy, for drivers of vehicles to leap into when the Royal Air Force came over shooting up transport. And I got into there. And then, until first light, everything was dead quiet. And at about first light, the first reaction of the enemy started,
and they started pushing shell fire into those leading houses. And at the same time, they put a very bad patrol on the other side. There's completely open ground, the end of the village there, and they put a very badly conducted patrol in across that open ground. The chaps in the houses there let that patrol come absolutely right in. Then they opened up with everything they had and killed the lot. And they left us alone then for a little time. Now, gentlemen, if I had been asked that night to give anybody a chronological, hour-by-hour, blow-by-blow account of what happened for the rest of that day in this village, I don't think I could have done it. It was a confused, noisy day. It was episodic, if I can put it in that way. And all I can do is to give you an impression of it. If it sounds confused, that is right, because it was utter confusion. What the Germans did was to put in penny packet attacks on us all day. They didn't use an awful lot of men, but they used a hell of a lot of firepower on us. They had SP tanks. They had tanks themselves. I was told by a Frenchman, well, I didn't see it on the day, that there was down the lane to the left of that crossroads a tank in there, a German tank, was shooting straight up across here. And they had at least one armoured car, which did on one stage come right in. They got in to that half of the village. They attacked David Hunter's Cameronian boys up there repeatedly. They got in between us and the rest of the battalion, with whom we had no communication because we had no wireless sets. And one simply couldn't spare a man as a runner, and we didn't think he'd get through anyway. But they put in these penny packet attacks on us, which were pressed home quite hard. And what we did, and I think we were dead right, was to let them come right in. And then when they were really in there, we let them have everything we had. The troops held their fire magnificently until the Germans were right in, and then let them have everything. And we managed to push them away every time. But we were all the time having casualties from the shell fire and mortar fire and so on, which was coming down. In particular, those leading houses over there, leading edge houses, were becoming almost untenable. What we did was to pull the chaps out of them into the back and leave just a scout up in a bedroom to tell us when the next lot was coming in, and then they would reoccupy the houses and push the enemy, the Germans out again, shoot them up. But they were in here. There was a tank, as I say, as I heard subsequently, down that lane. It was all very close stuff. At about 8:30, there was an attack coming in on the Cameronians, and I was lying on my stomach on the bank just down here by the road, trying to see what was going on. And just to my right, as I lay, facing that direction, there was a telegraph pole, wooden one. And it was either this tank thing or a SP, something. It was a fairly high velocity thing. Fired a shell which hit this telegraph pole, and a piece of that shell came down. Nobody was lying on my stomach, passed over the back of my right thigh and went quite high up into the inside of my left thigh. A very close one thing, gentlemen, indeed. That made me rather immobile for the rest of the day. But I was fortunate in that I had Jim Webber, my second in command of my company, who was magnificent the whole day. During the course of the day, he went up into this house. Now, earlier on, before things really hotted up, the windows of that house upstairs had opened, and a whole lot of women, young women, were looking out and making sort of fairly inviting gestures to us. And I had my suspicions that it was perhaps the local German army brothel. We didn't see it for the rest of the day, and we did not have the opportunity to find out whether our surmise was right, unlike that famous Canadian soldier who went to Dieppe, came back completely unscathed, except that he managed to get himself what we knew in those days as a full house. Which is a very good example, gentlemen, of maintenance of the objective. But Jim Webber went up in there and he had a sniper rifle with him, which he picked up off one of our snipers who'd been killed. And this armored car thing was right, came right up into the village street. Just up there, by that, where that lorry is now. And the commander was stupid enough to open his hatch and put his head out. And Jim shot him straight through the head and came down absolutely delighted with himself to tell me about it down here. The road itself was completely untenable. We couldn't cross it. It was completely dominated by enemy fire. You could not cross it at all. And we used to shout to the chaps over on the other side of the street. If you can imagine this fire going on almost continuously and then intensifying as one of these attacks came in, this house over here in flames, burning like mad, all the roof crashing in, another one up there in the same way, and it really was bloody noisy in here. In the early afternoon, two Sherman tanks appeared down the road behind you. And this was to us the most wonderful sight, I can tell you. But after this armored car got in, we had slid onto the road surface a whole lot of anti-tank grenades. I think there were 95 grenades, their number. And they were a sort of tin, sort of like a boot polish tin, bigger than that, about this big, with a flange on top, and you slipped a fuse in underneath. And we'd skated these across the road. And the whole road here was covered with them. And we wanted to stop these tanks. We wanted to tell them what the situation was, and we were there, and we didn't want them to run over these grenades, which we couldn't pick up because you couldn't get onto the road without getting yourself killed. So we hung our berets on the rifle barrels, waved those, and we held out Celanese yellow triangles, which we all carried, which were an aircraft recognition thing. They took not a blind bit of notice. They came straight on, closed right down, straight over the anti-tank grenades, none of which went off, and they went straight on up through this village on their own, and they were, of course, quite inevitably, brewed up further down the road. What they were doing, I haven't the faintest idea. They came, I believe, from the 13th, 18th Hussars, I was told afterwards. But those chaps were seemed to be going to take con on their own. A German tank did, in fact, come right in here. I had one Piat. You were told about the Piat. It's the thing, projector infantry anti-tank, big cumbersome thing, which fired a bomb off a spigot. And the propellant charge was in the tail of the bomb itself. You had to fire them from there close, too. And I had this Piat just down beside my slit trench. And we could hear this tank moving up very slowly. And don't forget, there was this high wall there in those days. And I was going to be a company commander's fire order, this one. And I have the Piat gunner beside me, this Piat, waiting for this tank for its tracks to appear around the corner of the wall. Eventually it did, and I said, right, fire! And he pressed the trigger, and there was a click. And what had happened, he turned round to me and said, it's bent, sir. And it was. The spigot thing had bent. So nothing happened. But we all carried in those days plastic high explosives in our battle dress, in our pockets. And we used to make things up called a gammon bomb, which was named after a Lieutenant Gammon who invented it in North Africa. And you had a mechanism, and you made a hole. You made a ball of plastic. You put your thumb in to make a hole, and you put the primer in there, the mechanism. It had a stockinette bag, open-ended one, attached to it, with elastic around it. You pull that down over the HE, took the cap off, it had a very short tape on it, and bunged it, and it used to flatten very slightly before it went off, and it was very, very effective indeed. You almost had something like a shaped charge. Anyway, we saw this chap off. We all hurled gammon bombs at him, and he yukered off out of it as quick as he could go, and I did hear, that he, in fact, did brew up further back down the road, which was we were pretty pleased about. Well, now, gentlemen, we should have been relieved at about 12 o'clock by the 2nd East Yorks. In fact, we weren't relieved until after 5 o'clock in the evening. By the mid-afternoon, we were really very thin on the ground. I think we were down to about 20 chaps still on their feet. And Jim Webber went back. He got through, to Geoffrey Pinecoffin and told him how thin on the ground we were, and there wasn't going to be an awful lot of us left. And Geoffrey got a scratch platoon together under one of the young 60th officers, Atkinson, and they came up into the village on the other side of the road, and that relieved the situation enormously. It just about doubled our strength. And we hung on in here until we were relieved, in fact, by a battalion of the Royal Warwicks. And they came up and put an attack on us here and pushed the Germans out of it, and we were able to go out. Now, we evacuated our wounded in a thing called a white scout car. This was an American lightly armoured thing. There were two versions, a wheeled one and a half-track. This was the wheeled one. Had red crosses on it. And it's right to say that although that road had been completely denied to us all day by fire, the Germans never fired on that vehicle when it was taking wounded out of them. And we went back down to our very well-sighted RAP, which was at the Pegasus Bridge Cafe. And I got carted in there, and our doctor patched me up, and then I went outside and sat in the evening sunshine. Don't forget, we were on double summertime in those days. That's why it was very light in the evening. Sat in the evening sunshine drinking champagne. And it was a very pleasant contrast to after being in this village all that day to sit there in the sun drinking champagne, I can tell you. And then one saw, I think, the best sight of the whole day. On the landing zone, on this side of the canal, and beyond Benouville, the evening lift of gliders came in. This huge stream of aircraft, tearing gliders, gliders casting off, we can see them coming down, dive breaks out, very steep dive, and the aircraft were also doing a resupply drop with containers. And very soon after we'd seen that, all these chaps came pouring down over the bridges with all the equipment in the world. Jeeps, machine guns, mortars, the lot. All fit, fresh chaps. And that was the most marvellous sight for us. And we really, I think, I at any rate felt, when that happened, that we'd done it, we'd made it, with these chaps coming in. I was evacuated that night down to the beach and then back to UK in a landing ship tank and finished up in a hospital at Stoke-on-Trent in Staffordshire. In the next bed to be was an officer by the name of Ken Darling, who's done well since, I believe. And he'd been wounded in the left forearm. And after they'd put it together again and put him into plaster, he was up. And I remember for the first 4 days, when the little nurse used to come around and take your temperature and your pulse count and all this thing, he used to ask you the $64,000 question, yes or no. And for about 4 days, we all said no. Must have been some reaction from the operation, I suppose. But after being dosed, we all managed a yes, except for a three French officer in the corner bed, I remember, of the ward, and he said no. And that afternoon, Ken Darling was lying on his bed, wearing his battle dress, reading a paperback novel. And this little nurse came in, and she put screens up round his bed. He took another blind bit of notice. And then she came with a trolley, with a decently covered with a white cloth, and wheeled it between the screens. And he then appreciated the appalling assault on his person, which he was about to perpetrate. And Ken Darling jumped up and he shot out between the screens. We were all watching this for some amusement, I may say. Shot out between the screens, made for the door of the ward, shouting, I said yes, that bugger said no. And we didn't see him for about 2 hours. Very easy thing to say, facilely like that. But I did mention earlier on, over on the DZ, that we were really a very good battalion, and our morale was enormously high. I think I could only say, if asked the same question again now, that there was never any question about anything else. That's all there was to it.
The next recording is of Eddie Warren, who, in Normandy, commanded Support Company 12 Devon, which was part of the Air Landing Brigade in 6th Airborne Division. He was sitting in his slip trench down by the landing zone one sunny day, feeling rather bored, and heard that one of the companies of 12 Devon was due to take part in 12 Parabattalion's attack on Breville that evening. And because he had nothing better to do, he persuaded the CO that he should go as support company commander, watch the battle and report back to him at the end of the battle. And looking forward to a good swan, he set off. And he takes up the story just as he's arriving at the back end of the FUP.
Anyway, another 200 yards on, and I got out of my jeep just opposite the entrance to a large farm yard at the bottom of this lane. There was, of course, by now, a most frightful din from the artillery program, and any conversation, if you had it with anybody, had to be conducted by shouting at each other. there was a most tremendous din. The smoke had started by now to drift back in this direction from the objective, and even at this early stage, the blue sky had become obscured, and there was a general greyness beginning to descend on the orchards and the general scene round behind you. As I passed this farmyard, I was very disconcerted to see two brigadiers being carried out on stretchers, feet first, lot of red flannel and blood about, and this, I thought, was not good. And so I then continued into the bottom of this lane, where one, of course, joined the platoons and men of 12th Parachute Battalion, who were slowly working their way forward up the lane, which was extremely narrow and fanning out into what one deduced was the forming up place for the attack, into the orchards on either side of the lane, one back from the one behind you here. Now, they were packed really like sardines in this confined area, but they were slowly fanning out and getting into some sort of formation. I came on past them and came into the second orchard back from you on this side of the road, and there I found John Bamfield, who I had come to see. And I said, "What's going on?" And he said, "Well, I have not had time to give anything but the very briefest orders to my platoon commanders, and they have had no time to pass on any orders to the section commanders." So I said, "Is there anything I can do?" He was, as I say, fairly harassed and worried. All this sort of conversation being conducted at the top of our voices to make ourselves heard. And he said, "Yes, if you would like to go back and help get the rear platoons of the company forward, push them on, because H hour's in about another quarter of an hour's time, and we're all going to be bloody late." So I went back down through this milling mass, shoved the rear platoons on, chivied them along as much one could in the congested space, and I then came forward again with them, and just at that moment, I had then moved on to the left of the lane, that side of the lane, just at that moment, what one took to be enemy defensive fire, both mortar and artillery, started to come down in these orchards and amongst these chaps who were very closely packed together. Everybody went to ground, sensibly enough, and this stuff started doing an awful lot of damage. It went on for some minutes, I suppose. I can't tell you how many. It seemed a long time, as usual, when you're under any sort of fire. And when it stopped, I should say, by the way, that by now visibility, owing to the smoke drifting back, was down to about 10 yards.
I had now become personally extremely frightened and worried about what the hell really was going on. Now, when this shelling stopped, there were, as I say, a considerable number of dead and wounded lying around, and so, for the want of something better to do, the first thing I then did was to spend some 4 or 5 minutes, I suppose, helping some of the worst of the wounded, getting out their field dressings and getting their morphine things out and so on. That was, I don't say it was the right thing to do at all, but anyway, that's what I did, and it gave one something positive to do. Having done that, I then thought I'd better go and find John Bamfield again and possibly get with him and see a bit more about what was going to happen in the attack.